fan.
You know how when they yell cut, they wouldn't stop.
That's interesting.
What?
Yeah.
If you were Donna, what would you have said?
A waitress, rather, call the police. And she was mistaken in 90210 for cops.
Along with your host, Charles Rosen.
Look at that Dean Cake. And Dan probably got the best performance he ever gave.
We're having a meeting here?
Oh, at least there's one person on this Percata set that knows what they're doing.
Larry Mullen.
I had a friend named Craig Richland. There was still cocaine around and stuff. I always remembered him, and I just kind of thought I would honor my coke dealer.
Get out of here!
Pete Ferrero.
Here's what I learned. It's possible Claire would have gone out with me.
That was your takeaway.
So sit back and relax, because it's like totally time for the Beverly Hills 90210 show.
Just hold on to me tonight.
Okay, here we are back again on the Beverly Hills 90210 show, going all the way back to season one to talk about higher education. Want to say hi to Charles Rosen first. Charles, it's been a minute since you've been live on the show here. You've been traveling all over. You were in London.
International man, what can I tell you? It's London one day, Paris the next.
It's literally like that for you.
But we took a big, bold trip to really celebrate the accomplishment of Cruel Intentions, the musical, opening in London. Finally, it's a show that my daughter co-wrote and directed starting in 2015 in LA. She then went to New York and repeated a production there in 2017 as a co-writer and a director. Went on a national tour. Played in Australia, played at the Fringe Festival, was voted Best Musical. And then it finally opens in London, and the reviews were just one of those things. I just looked today, they have the thing when you go to the theater and then you can, fans or people who saw the show can make comments.
Yes.
There were 28 comments and everyone was a 5-star.
Oh, that's just amazing.
That's great.
May it be able to transfer into, a lot of people coming out to see the show.
And more success with that, because
London has always been a really an engaging and edgy theater town, or at least for the last 20, 25 years. So I hope that they support this show, because it was just, and anybody who's in London or has friends going to London, or this, especially who's got some connection to the 90s, which,
yes,
if you're listening to this podcast, theoretically you have some kind of emotional connection to the 90s.
For
I can't
sure.
think of what it might be. Oh yes, 90210. But this is the 90s musical with the, and the only one song did Lindsay put in her show that we used on the show. And of course that's the show that song that was not from the 90s but the 80s, and that was REM's Losing My Religion.
Love that. Mm-hmm. Love that. You got to see some. Hello to Brian Navarro as well, our Reddit analyst, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Authority, not an analyst, an authority.
Yeah. I keep him in check.
Oh, I don't know if you do. I feel like I saw some posts there a couple of days ago that I was like, this entire planet has gone nuts the way they're talking about 90210.
It's a wild ride, that page.
Chuck, you got to see Louisa, or Louise. How is she doing?
She's great. That way you see us there. You could see we were bundled because London was not warm. Neither was Paris, but London was really cold. And that morning, this was the morning of the 19th. The 19th was that Friday that we went to see Lindsay's show later, that night. But this, she came to meet us. This was around noon, or well, you can see with the clock, it's just a little before 2,
that's
I
right.
guess.
Big
and
day.
And she had never been to inside Westminster Abbey. So
wow.
I don't know if you have that shot. I know Larry had that one with she
I
and I.
I don't have that shot. I don't have that shot.
I mean,
shot.
It's pretty amazing. The monks were doing pagan rites on the land there at like 1060, AD. So it's this land had been really gone back, and it's such an interesting place. So it was a great, we got that. Then we split off, she and I and the girls and Karen went up the Thames, and we went off to have lunch at a place called Wakamama, for anybody who knows the fast food scene of London. It's pretty good stuff.
And then you got to go to Paris. And what's so cool, I love Anna Leon. I just want to say that out loud. I love all of her photos on Instagram, her with different records and stuff. And you got to hang out with her and have what looks like some sort of ice cream sundae here with her.
Yeah, we stayed for dessert for this one. We went, it's a restaurant called Vaudeville for some, and it was one that goes back to like 1918. Which is a strange year to start a restaurant because that's the year that World War One ended. I mean, but nonetheless, you're in there real quick.
Right.
Quick, you know, clean up the streets, get those dead bodies out. World War One's over. We're starting now. Have a fun restaurant, you know. But anyway, that's kind of how it was there. So we went in there and that was really a lot of fun. We had, but Anna was great. We saw her another night. She came over to the Left Bank where we were staying, and we had a drink and stuff before parting ways, saying goodbye.
Very nice. The other thing that happened while you were away is that a friend of the podcast and someone that you've known for a really long time, David Gale, passed away.
He passed away in Paris.
While you were in Paris.
While I was coming to Paris. Actually, I was in London the night that we traveled on the 21st, that Sunday. Mm-hmm. And I think he may have passed away that Monday. I don't know what day it was.
Yes.
Well, no, it was that Sunday because I know that Monday. I also had a very fun thing. Why am I not bringing this up to our fan base? You know, Karen, Maxine, and I, that first thing Monday morning, hustled off from the hotel when Darren Starr said, "We're filming in the city if you'd like to come watch."
Oh,
and
nice.
We went to a cafe that was also on the Left Bank, but closer to the Eiffel Tower, actually. And we got there just in time as they were turning around. So we got to see them film Lily Collins' close-up. And it was the first shot they did of the season. So it was really a great thing. And of course, Darren is the creator of 90210 and written so much of our good stuff in the first two seasons.
But David Gale
passed. So Darren and I, I'm sorry, that was my segue into it, because Darren said the thing that also was really hard to put my hands around a little bit. Even with the great experiences and wonderful conversations that we did have on the podcast together,
David Gale,
here's David Gale. He's been an actor for all of these different things, and they say he has a heart. And so he's a character actor. He has a heart attack.
Yes.
So put it in the scale of the world. A character actor has a heart attack. But the thing that made this character actor unique was what was they were talking about, which were the headlines on the Daily Beast, the things that I saw, which was that he had done 8 episodes of Beverly Hills 90210. He had become a 90210 actor.
That's right.
And that for 8 episodes that he did in a character arc. And it was just odd that someone like that, God bless him and may his spirit soar, as our friend Larry would say, as well as resting in peace, of course. That was where he would be the recognition would be for. While it was just a sliver, he had a whole life. It was just a sliver of this, but it was a character arc. I'm not diminishing it, but it just seemed that proportional to being the top item to find out that he had a heart attack on the cheat sheet of the Daily Beast seemed incongruous to me.
Yeah.
So David would have no opinion on, I think he would be rather, he was a modest man. So I think he'd be a little embarrassed by that in his own way.
He would not have liked being labeled a soap star. I'm sure that would have bothered him a bit. Being an actor on 90210 was something I know that he was super proud of, but being labeled a soap star.
But there he was. So Darren, who's, in the midst of doing his, sixth or seventh television show, looks at the proportion of it, because, again, when we reached 100th episode, we had a party and we were all done, and they weren't going to let me speak. It was moving on. Mr. spoke, Sandy Grushow spoke. They didn't need me to speak. But I wanted to just to say one thing as I lifted it up, particularly for the few of the actors who were there and a few others who were there from Fox Broadcasting at the time, that this was for the people who can remember the first 12. And Darren was one of the people who knew the first 12. That's for sure. The first 12 were, and we're talking about number 5 tonight. So that is even in the first 6. That's when the, you know, when 7 to 12 seem like a stretch.
Yes.
Which is get through the first 6, which is what
we're going to talk about to. That. I'm going to play an ad, and then when we come back, we'll dive into this episode, which is higher education.
Hey, Beverly Hills 90210 fans. Check out all the latest rad stuff from the Beverly Hills 90210 show shop. They have everything you could possibly imagine. So, like, go there now, okay?
Okay, that's an ad. Let's talk about this episode, higher education. This goes way back for you. There's a lot happening in this in your world at this point. The show is brand new. You have no idea if you're going to get more episodes. You're. It's very experimental, I guess, to some degree. Remind everybody what it was like to be working on this show in those days.
Well, here's how I used to describe those days was that imagine that you wake up in the morning and you know that there's a meteor with your name on it. And that meteor is going to hit you and it's going to find you because that's the nature of things.
Right.
And it's going to take you, once it does, it's going to take you 2 to 3 hours to dig out of the debris. And a bad day is when 3 or 4 meteors arrive all at once. That's what it felt like.
There is a lot of meteors coming your way.
There's a constant thing because you also, you had a first-time showrunner. So the proportion of stuff was hard to gauge. What do you focus on? What do you do? Duke Vincent asked me, how are you going to spend your days? Are you going to go to post-production? Are you going to go to the mixes? Are you going to do this? Are you going to go to that? I didn't know what anybody did. All I knew was that it was my job as the head writer to get the shows out, get the episodes out, get the stuff done. I had come off of, you know, as pre-90210 as a writer, the guys I worked for we had the same agent, and one of them is John Falls, he's passed away, but Josh Brand is living in New York City, and these are the guys who I worked with on, who I met doing White Shadow, who I worked on their series, Saying Elsewhere, Amazing Stories, and Northern Exposure, and who, I'm in my office looking at my only Emmy Award nomination, and it was with the show we did together at Northern. Unfortunately, no 90210 in that pedigree, but so these guys, I had told me that the only thing I had to know was that production is so hard that you just had to not make scripts your problem. And the only way not to make scripts your problem is if scripts are ready on time. So that the day the director goes on into the office and checks in, he's given, here's what we're filming. So that he doesn't have to waste a day or two and then play catch up and then play catch up. But it always felt like we were playing catch up to all of it. And, you know, as we talked about with our first episode, that we made our first day. We did not go into overtime. And that was probably what saved my entire working experience there, because we were credible from the first day not the other way around.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So when we got to this episode, thinking about this episode, and because my prime focus at one level at this point was getting the scripts together, this was, we had a very young staff, and you know, we've got you, Darren, you know, who was the creator and of a pilot that nobody liked. So he had a chip on his shoulder in that regard.
Very
and
long.
The time I realized, which was really mostly his first script, but also definitely his second script, Perfect Mom, that this guy's a major writer and much better than what they were asking him to do in the pilot. He was already, you know, worked up about the fact that I didn't know what the fuck I was doing, which he had a right to be, because I didn't really know the fuck I was doing. I was right. I wasn't even, it isn't even that I was a guy who worked on the series. You know, I just rattled those things off that I had done with the guys who did Northern Exposure. But the fact of the matter is, I spend my time writing movies for television and pilots. In other words, by myself. You know, I wasn't interacting with people. I didn't do that. I did that when I was in high school, when I was Brandon Walsh, but not when I was, you know, a working TV guy.
And now here you are with a non-union show, you know, taking over the helm of being the showrunner as well, which is a whole new experience.
Well, I think I've told the story about Mr. Spelling's business, what, you know, the head of his company at that point, a man named Jules Heimovitz, who we did have on this podcast. Anybody who's interested in the business of what that was all about,
that was great. Yeah.
Look up Jules. Pete interviewed him. We did it together. Yeah. But Jules, and I told this story on that one, which is that Jules wanted to talk to me on my first day of work and when I was finished with Mr. Spelling. So when that happened, I went next door and I'm sitting down and he's just fumbling with papers and not making this a big thing. Like, he's kind of distracted, but he says to me, he says, you know, I'm looking at you and I getting a feel for you and you're going to take what Mr. Spelling, what he's gotten, this kind of thing. But there's one thing you got to know, because I can tell it's something that nobody has ever said this to you before. And that is, you are management. And I had never been management. I had only been labor. Yeah. He was like, "Uh-oh, I'm busted now. I'm labor." But the fact of the matter is, I, especially working with Duke Vinson and understanding some of the mindset of what it meant to be management, it was a duck to the pond. You know, it was.
I don't mean to go on a sideways track here, but you know, one of the things that I loved about when David Gale was on the show was that he told a bunch of great Duke Vinson stories. And I remember when he did that, you loved that. I mean, I have never seen you laugh as much as when David Gale was sharing stories about Duke Vincent lifting him up by the throat in a bathroom or saying he has to fly when, you know, he'll come pick him up himself to get him from Jersey, or all that stuff that David Gale was talking about. But for the context of this universe, I would love for you to tell people who Duke Vincent was in the world. I mean, we see his name on the show every week, right? How did you meet Duke Vincent, and what was Duke Vincent like?
Well, Duke Vincent was he was rough and tumble and smooth at the same time. He was kind of muscle and taste, a certain new frontier taste, the next generation, the post-World War II generation. He was military. He flew the planes. He threw. He was not a Navy SEAL, but whatever the Navy pilots are called at that point. That's what the Blue Angels.
That's right.
That was him. He also somehow was linked to John Kennedy as a part of his personal detail, especially when they were in at different places. And Duke, so it had that kind of like swinging. He was kind of a combination of Carlo Gambino meets Dean Martin. You know, it just was a smooth blend, Duke was. And yet he was tough. And so when I met him, what I had been tipped off about was that he was really pissed I was in the building. Because how dare the Fox Broadcasting Company tell him and Aaron that they can't be the producers of their own television show. In other words, the fact that they were working with propaganda. So that's something that he hadn't gotten over 6 months ago. And now, here's the salt just got poured on his wounds. This guy just walks in the door. Yeah. So Duke wasn't really warm or friendly to me for the first couple of days there. That's for damn sure. But we had a moment at a certain point after they, you know, had started and found they didn't have an office for me and were in the back of working at the post-production facility for Twin Peaks. That's where propaganda had. And then they, Duke came, walked around and looked at it and said, no, this is no good. You have to come into our offices. And they had a huge office and the office in a whole little section unto myself, which was great, but it was definitely a corporate office, not a production style studio office by any stretch of the imagination. Not at all what we had going over at Calvert Street. Mm. Quite the opposite, actually. And so anyway, the big moment with Duke and I, which kind of defines it, is we were working on the budget and we felt strongly that that the budget was $50,000 short, and Duke flipped out and just took the $50,000 out, and I got not happy about it, and he's really pissed off that I'm not happy about it, because what the fuck do I know about budgets?
Right.
And he starts railing about that, and he just starts going, school is in session, school is in session. And I grabbed, there are like five other producers in the room doing this, what's going on. And I pick up the phone and go, that's right. And the principal and the president of the school board has put me in charge of the show. So if you'd like to talk to Peter Chernin, I'll dial the phone for you. We can get him on the phone right now and you can talk about that, because he's the one who put me in this place to do this job. If you got a problem with that, you talk to him. And everybody in the fucking room saw that. And I could see Duke at that moment, as pissed as he was, getting his little smile on his face, going, oh yeah, I can work with this kid. And we got on pretty well. I really learned a lot. Like, for instance, any time that the network wanted something done that was a material upgrade for what we already had in the approved script, it was to ask, who's going to pay for this? Or when they wanted us to have a star of the show. So, for instance, we were talking about, if we segue now out of our good friend Duke and back to the episode
of Learning After. Duke is still with us, by the way.
Who are listening, being willing to go down the memory lane with me here. But, you know, we had Ray Walston, and Ray Walston was one of the actors who was known for My Favorite Martian. Some of you may remember him on Picket Fences. I remember him playing the devil in Damn Yankees on Broadway, a really big star. And he's coming in willing to read for the part of Mr. Denzel, who, of course, is named after Denzel Washington. We knew him. My little son, who was just born, was in the same class as Denzel's son. So that's how we started to know each other. And so, yes, that's how the Denzel comes from. And anyway, but Ray Walston was someone who would have cost extra to play the part, which is probably why we didn't even think about casting him when the world was done.
Well, what you're referring to is, so I asked Diane Young, who is amazing and just a wonderful human being, and she wanted to join us tonight, but the timing didn't work out. But so what Diane does is she sends us paperwork, and also a really great quote I'll read in a little bit when we get into this. But the casting of Mr. Denzel or Denzel is really important because he's a pivotal role in this episode. And she sent us the list of people that were also up for the role of Mr. Denzel. Chuck, let's talk about some of these people that are on this list. As you mentioned, Ray Walston, John Anderson, who I wasn't really sure who that was.
Well, the one who's the crazy one on this list is the third one down, Seymour Cassell.
Yes.
Seymour Cassell was an actor who would be in the group with of really like kind of like off-Broadway cinema, you know. There wasn't even, it was a, you know, the group, the guy who would make the tough guy movies. It wasn't oh, I'm doing him a poor justice by not remembering now. You're going to have to thump all of this out. Sorry, anybody who's listening to this live. But Seymour Cassell was just, it was just not at all right for our show. It would be like, you know, having like, oh, yeah, we're going to need a band for the Peach Pit. All right, let's use Lou Reed. You know, no, it's not going to work. You know, it's just,
right.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, so. Pete, you mentioned John Anderson, who that's one of the names I recognize. I know him from, he did a pretty famous Star Trek The Next Generation episode.
Yes.
Season 3, The Survivors.
Yes.
John Anderson.
The guys that I had, there are a couple that I didn't know about this list. This list wasn't shown. I'd sit in the office and the ones that come in, she read for us. But the John Colum is one and on this list. And John Colum was an actor who did Northern Exposure. And I was involved with the casting of him, at least the conversation. I saw his auditions and weighed in on saying, yeah, I like him. And yeah. Supported that's because that's who the company wanted. And then Kevin McCarthy was the lead of the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Mm.
And I didn't know he was there, but Lilla McCarthy, who went on to be a very successful and respected network executive over the years for different companies and different positions, is a friend. And I knew, so that was here, that Kevin was her father. So that was really good. And then there's a guy named Eugene Roach, who we also cast in another television series I did in the early 80s. So, and he was a very nice guy and had a good role and was very good. So
he was he was the Ajax guy back in the 70s, wasn't he?
He may have been.
Yeah.
He may have been.
I know most people from
that. And we had him play a character kind of like Jerry Falwell.
Mm.
And he was very good at it.
Seymour Cassell was also in Rushmore, and like as he got older, he was in some movies as he aged. He was in really good stuff, and I think I know Ray. I'm sorry, Ray Walston. Wasn't he Popeye in the Popeye movie?
Mm.
I'm pretty sure that.
Oh, you mean he may have had a co-star in that? He may have been Robin Williams was Popeye.
No, right, yeah. He was he wasn't Popeye, but he was in that, he was the older man in Popeye. I don't remember what his role was, but I can remember seeing him in that movie.
Yeah, well, Popeye might have been in my life maybe one of the most disappointing movies ever made, you know.
Yeah.
expected it to be just outrageously great, and it is one that we can't even remember if Ray Walston was in it or not. So there you go.
I remember it was on HBO all the time when I was a kid.
Another one you might know, Pete. What was it? Dick O'Neill is a name on there. You might recognize it since you're a big Three's Company fan. If it's the Dick O'Neill, I think it is. It's the guy in the Jack on the Lamb episode where Jack gets in drag because he thinks the FBI is after him. Mm-hmm. If it's the same Dick O'Neill, it's the one he plays it the guy like, that.
There were a lot of Dick O'Neill, Dan O'Neill. Yeah, it sounds like I knew some of the names too, but I couldn't place them all. But these are ones that I'm saying to myself, I would have said, oh, just cast this person and not ever get to meet this guy, Bill Murray, who actually played the part. You got a clip on him, Pete?
I have a bunch of different Bill Murray clips. By the way, here he is in Popeye. Not to really get into all the
work. My favorite Martian is the one that
yes, obviously.
You would look out and go back. That's the one to get to.
But the actor, Bill Murray is so good in this. Here is Bill Murray when I was going to save this for a little bit later, but this is the big moment where Diane says that when they came in to read, I'm trying to find that. They read this scene. This is one of the scenes that the actors read.
Retiring this year.
Well, there comes a time when one must move on. I know you don't consider me to be a particularly effective teacher, but there are those who feel I do a good job.
Well, I didn't mean...
Don't insult my intelligence, Mr. Walsh. I know the kids don't like me. I hear the comments. I hear the constant complaining, the jokes about my clothes. I am not deaf yet. But those same students, they may not like me, but they will remember my class, and they will remember what they learned. The truth is, I'm not terribly impressed with a lot of my clothes myself. My wife picked them all out for me. She was ill. She knew I didn't have the patience to shop for myself. She was bound and determined that I would have enough clothes to wear at... The one thing I've got to help me remember. Good grief. As much as I hate to admit it, I probably could change a tire if I had to.
That's really nice stuff. I think he's incredible.
Yeah, that had something, you know. Karen, by which certainly when we were doing the show, she was buying my clothes. She wanted me to look, you know, hip and authoritative. So I started wearing like colored shirts and ties to work and stuff like that. So can definitely relate to that notion of clothes. And Karen, this was a hard episode to write and get there. We had a first time writer on the staff, and he wasn't prepared to getting notes, and he kind of shut down. So we had to kind of jump in on this first one, but he was a terrific young writer and did really great things for us as we went to the other episodes. That's Jordan Booty, who did some good ones, but this one required. So you see a little bit of that Karen's touch in there with the clothes.
Well, here's what Liz says. Liz says, I just have to say, this is one of those episodes that hit me harder as an adult. Chuck has a way of writing episodes that are very heartfelt. And this is one of those great episodes. Very nice comment from Liz.
Thank you, Liz.
I agree with that. Yeah, and I think when I remember in school, I think there was someone, a teacher that reminded me of this actor.
Yeah, well, we all had one, and I wanted to bring that up. So here's, because this is one of those episodes that you would expect being number five, that really comes out of the experience of Beverly Hills High School, in that Beverly Hills, you know, what they did is they put all the honor students together as top tiers, and they put them in something called teen teaching. And that was then for all college-bound students. So all college-bound students were competing against the honor students as well. I was a very lazy student. I watched a lot of television when I was in middle. I didn't make great grades, you know. So I needed to accelerate. So I did not go into the college prep ones. I went into the old school classes, the U.S. history and English, both being taught separately by two longtime Beverly Hills faculty members. And the one and the woman, Vivian Gibbons, was incredibly hip and taught us about to know things about LSD and what we were taking and what was available in this, because a lot of the kids weren't going to call, you know, were a little bit on the edge and more experimental. So she was very cool and very interesting and did some great things. And I always will appreciate Miss Gibbons. But Mr. Ockapenny is the one that Bill Murray's character Mr. Denzel is based around. And the thing is that the cheating in Ockapenny's class was much more profound than this. So you have to understand and look at it this way. I'm in the class and I love American history and I'm going to do well and I want to do well. And in another section that Mr. Ockapenny taught, my friend David Lewis was in that class, and we started, and we were friends and different things. we started to become close friends during this period of time. And I come over on Sundays and we'd study together. David's parents are the people who founded Hamburger Hamlet. Mm. And if anybody knows in D.C., Chicago, here in Los Angeles, it's an incredibly interesting culture and history. It became the restaurant Kate Manolini's. David's great. I hope to have lunch with him in the next week or so. Hadn't seen him in a while. But we would go over there and work together. And he wanted to get the A and be proud of what he would learn about it. And we had a quiz every week. And now it's the end of the year. And one of my friends steals the final. So he's got the final there for anybody to look at it. And of course, David and I are not going to do that. We're not interested in that. We're not going to be. But there were others that were very interested in doing that. And in fact, did do that. So here's what happens at the end of the day, because there's a curve, the dreaded curve that we talked about. So one of my friends, oh, I'll say which one it is because he's not listening anyway. I have a friend who lives in the conductor, my friend who lives in England.
Yes.
In Cambridge, where I went to elementary school and high school and this. So he, had that and he wanted to get into a good school and whatever. His thing was music at the time, but still there was that pressure. And he wrote, he turned it in and he didn't make any mistakes. He made it get 100. Like he got it all. He was an idiot for doing that, but that's what he did. Mm. Okay. Then came David and I. I don't know. I missed one or two. David missed one or two. We were next. We were kind of like how Andrea was there in the beginning. You know, it's going to be what's going to be. I'm going to memorize all this shit. He's making me memorize. And then there were others that took a couple more off in this. But the guy who stole it didn't want to be too obvious. So he made it that he took 6 off. But because there were 4 really high ones, the curve was higher. And he got a B and didn't get an A. You fucking steal the final and all you can get is a B? Who the hell are you? And now you want to, you know, you come to me and say, I'd like to represent, you know, you and be your broker at Merrill Lynch. No, that's not going to happen, guy. You got a B.
God, that's
anyway,
funny.
Thought I'd share that story. So that's the original cheating story. And this is what we made out of that. I thought that would be interesting. And also relative to looking at this episode after long layover, and when I would think about this episode, did you ever see the original Fame?
Yes.
Or the TV show Fame?
I think so.
It's
been a long time, but yes.
So the guy, his name was Albert Sharansky or something. He was a big, heavy set guy, and he was the one in the music thing who was Mr. Morelli and all of that.
Yes.
And that's who I thought was the higher learning guy. I would get them and my memory get them mixed up. So it was really nice to see this wonderful performance by Bill Murray, who, by the way, was on you can't even believe when you go to IMDb and look this guy up, he's been on every television show that was there from like 1970s and 80s through the 90s, virtually every show.
That's a lot of the guys on the list as well. Yeah, a lot of those names on the list you had, really prolific television actors.
Yeah. They were the character actors willing to play a part like this.
Anne Fernando, hi, how are you, Anne? She says, high school episodes are my favorite. Also like how they were filmed compared to other seasons. Maggie says, hi, all. Hi, Maggie. I hope you're doing well. Beverly Thrills 90210 says, damn, Brian looking fine. So you got
to. Now we need some eye candy now. What do you want? You know, you got me. You got me, an old guy. So, you know, I could have said old guy Rosen, just not Rosen.
So let's look at this Andrea clip real quick because she is really fired up about all this.
I gotta talk to you.
You're not gonna talk about it.
God, you are so judgmental.
Yeah, you're damn right I am. I gotta see because you cheated. I didn't deserve that.
Talk to Denzel.
No, I'm talking to you because it's your fault.
Imagine being a student. What are they talking about? Even, you know, we were talking about
grades, which when you were in these pressure cooker schools, that's what people were talking about, the grades.
I mean, we talked about this on the Patreon, and I would love to ask Jason's opinion of this in season one. Let's just...
Can I be honest with you?
Yes.
When I was making C's in your class, you didn't have the time of day for me. Now that I'm making A's, you're very friendly and interested. Why is that?
I didn't know you when you were making C's.
Exactly. You never made the effort.
I have five classes
today. And no one's learning anything in any of them. Anyone can memorize a bunch of facts, but that doesn't mean they're learning anything.
Memorization lays the foundation for a college education where the ideas can be more fully examined.
By who? A bunch of students who've never been challenged to think, who've been told they're average because some unfair curve screws them around?
Are you listening to me, young man?
I can't stand here and listen to you pat yourself on the back. The way you teach and give grades is unfair. It alienates everybody and makes... It just doesn't work.
I just want came in for a burger, you know. He's here. You know, in this first season
he was on 10 the whole episode. Like, if you would have told me that Brandon's from New York, I would have believed you. He was going off on everybody. Poor Andrea took so much abuse.
She did. But Chuck, you had to have at some point a conversation about Jason, with Jason about how he was sort of doing that. Why don't you tell that for the people on Patreon, or for us, since you told us about on Patreon.
Okay, so, yeah, I remember exactly what it was. When he really, we'd been doing the show for a while at this point. We'd had different times, good conversations, love Jason all the time, love Jason today, just only good thoughts. But, you know, now we're in a position where whatever it was, one of the things that Jay was having trouble with was connecting how to deal with Brandon kind of stating strong opinions about the fairness of things, about being looking at the world, very critically or with almost a socialist bent every once in a while, when it came to Matt and having the building getting torn down and whatever, you know, just when that would rile him, or an East Side Story, we were talking about that, how to reconcile that. But it was a time when we were doing... the first episode where Emily Valentine comes to Beverly High, back to school. And we had we used the song Addicted to Love and all the everybody dressing to it in this. Well, Steve and Jessica had written a parody because they knew that Beverly High had parodies. And I was interested in doing that for something called A Low Day. They did a thing called Addicted to Clothes.
I love it. Yes.
Mm-hmm. It was great. It was great what they wrote. And so we approached Robert Palmer, who was the artist's management, and said, can we do this? And they said, yes. And then as we were about to film, they said no. And Robert Palmer's people said no. And so what that meant was that we would have to, then they would have to sing something different at the end. And that was Breaking Up Is Hard to Do, is what we ended up doing, the Neil Sedaka song. We just pulled that out of our oldies but goodies ass, as it were, for that song. Because what are we going to do? Oh, this one's available. I always do that one. You know, it could be cute and have them dress up and look like they were singers or players for Robert Palmer. But when this is all getting sorted out, the manager calls me. And he was a British guy, and British guys who were in the music business are notoriously tough and confrontational, and particularly still then, because punk was still the culture of the London music scene at that point. And I get this guy on the thing, and he says, I can't use the song. And I said, no, we're using the song. We're filming it today. And you got a problem with that, you let me know that right fucking now, because I'll give you Mr. Spelling's lawyer and you can just go fuck yourself, because we're doing that. You want to talk to our lawyers? This is the Spelling Company, sir. You really ready for that? And you know, never heard from him again. But Priestley had never seen that side of me, because he was my star and I was always nice and then the gist and trying to be cool and this. And I'm like, listen, motherfucker, have you met Duke Vincent? I'm a Duke Vincent Change assassin, you asshole. And I know who I work for. Do you know? You know, and so Jay sees that. And I know he doesn't remember this, but he looked over me and I looked at him and he said, don't you get it, Jay? Brandon is me. And that was the way that he realized that he could play. I think Spiganeris, he could play the characters with more nuance and more, it didn't have to always just be, you know, a war with oneself to get the point across.
Yeah.
It didn't, you know, to get points across, you know, I mean, so when we had an episode, you know, I mean, this is really off the beaten track, but here is the track we're on right now. Yep. So when we had an episode, the last one with I'm Late with Brenda, that got censored when they cut the 29 seconds out of saying that was late for her period and all of that and letting know on that. And they just cut the whole part of it out. That was the conversation about it. I wasn't told that was going to happen. So I learned it by watching television and wasn't really too happy about that. And Mr. Spelling knew that and called me up a couple of, it took him 2 days to call me back, but he called me back. He found the courage to call me back and he did. And I was working on the show on a Saturday night at 9:30. In fact, Jonathan Roberts, who was on staff at that point and ended up going on to rewrite The Lion King, he was in my back house office at the time. And what Aaron said to me on that phone call was the truest thing that he said to me in the 5 years we worked together. And I think was his true opinion of me, which he said, you'd be nothing without your passion. So as much as he fucking hated my passion, it allowed the show to at sometimes have some passionate moments. And the question was, how can you modulate passionate moments to be able to keep them within the bounds of conversation?
Yes. You know,
and that's a hard, and that's more of a mature thing. And so that was hard. So, but once Jay got that, if you think about that, you know, he did really lose it a lot with having to do with the building.
Yes.
Being torn down. But that was like, you know, grandpa versus pa. You know, that was like a family fight. You know, that was more than a ideological one.
I would love to know from Jason, when did he find Brandon? Like, that's a question that I would love to know. Because there's a moment where he finds him and then he's just him and he's... it's beautiful. He is great here. You know, I mean, I love all this young.
I do think that they all made a mistake on that. I think he really, and had, it was really clear that if I could have found a way to stay in at six, you know, we could have brought him back as president because totally. He liked having the power. He liked doing that stuff. He liked being in the college stories and being vital to the school and know what's going on and stuff. Like I felt that anyway, wasn't him in the romance part of the world.
Yeah.
But I thought that it fit his, you know, the part of his character that rose up to it. I mean, I know that he was an unwitting president. It was only because Josh Richland had died, but at the same time he liked going to, you know, DC.
Chuck, we have to talk about the other meteor that comes through you during this episode. I will show some clips of the meteor.
Ah, I know what you're talking about.
Okay.
It's really not that bad.
Should I wear the hat?
I will.
Brenda Walsh becomes a blonde.
Yeah. You know, it was one of those things. You got an A story, you need a B story. It seemed like a funny B story. And you know, you really gotta, it's interesting. Here we are in the fifth episode and you look at how Luke Perry and Jenny Garth were frolicking down the stairs and enjoying being in each other's company as young actors, rather than it was Kelly Taylor and Dylan McKay. But, you know, the young actors are doing that and they're really cool together and like, oh, that's the crowd. And then there's Brenda looking at it, and that's the blonde. It always had been, you know, the generation I'm in, it would always had been, do blondes have more fun? That was a question that was being asked in the early 60s. That really was a variation of, hello, would you like to be Marilyn Monroe? Why don't you, or Sandra Dee in Bye Bye Birdie, dye your hair, you know, become a blonde, become Anne Margaret, become, you know. Yeah.
Cindy Walsh has the line too, where she references the Beach Boys song. She says, you know, we all wanted to be California girls.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that was the thing of that. So you take that storyline and you're, and it just makes sense. You can do the scenes, you can figure out how to tell it, not knowing that one of the things your actress is super sensitive about is, you know, her relationship to blondes. That do blondes get advantage? Has this hurt her in casting? What other emotional things? Has there been a guy she lost? Because I had no idea, but she was really unhappy with the storyline and really detested the wig. Detested.
You know, it's so funny you mentioned that. It's funny you mentioned that, Chuck. That was one of the questions that somebody asked on the Reddit page. They wanted to get information on what was Shannon's feelings about the wig and the storyline in general.
Well, she hated it. That's what I'm saying to you. So it was right there, and let us know that really well. Let Mr. Spelling know it really well. When my position was a little more shaky, there's some interesting side stories that will come out of this. But the other was that, that was, I was saying to Pete yesterday when we were watching it, Brian, that, and anyone else who's listening, that it's indicative. When I say to you guys, we had the lowest license fee in all of television. Well, there were much better wigs to buy. There'd be sexy, cool wigs to buy, but you had to spend money to buy it. And if it wasn't in the budget, you're just going to do what you can and balance it with other things. And this is what you come up with. And so that was my friend Jeffrey White was still the line producer. This is pre-Paul Wagner. That's how far back this show goes. So he, you know, sticking to the letter, he's going to not make Spellings go over budget on anything. Because if we go over budget, our credibility is lessened.
Yeah.
So they do this. So I remember we're having this meeting in Spellings' office. And the supervising producer, whose name I'll leave out of it, is just prancing around like the prick he was, you know, about trying to explain, you know, by complaining about this wig and this kind of thing. And we were filming on Saturdays then, and Yanni Svetvatsin, who was the head of propaganda, turns to him and says, "What were you doing on Saturday? Where were you? What were you doing? Why couldn't you help out? Where were, you know?" And this is a guy who had was just about to challenge me on my stewardship of the show. That was about to happen, not today, the next day or the day after. Yeah. But it was right at this point. And Yanni came over to me right after that outburst. He said, "Why aren't you saying anything? Why aren't you doing this? You are the executive producer." And it was a really seminal moment because I went, you're only the executive producer. They can call you an executive producer, but you're not an executive producer until you are the executive producer. And I'm not there. I'm a long way from that.
Right.
And trying to think about, well, when was that? You know, when did I become the real executive producer? And it probably comes to bear with all of the flack from Brenda losing her virginity at the spring dance, coupled with the 30 seconds that get cut out.
Yeah.
Because that was unconscionable that you use that to promote it all week. And then you don't even have the balls to come through and deliver it. You know,
yeah.
I'm sorry to be partisan here, Pete, and or anyone else, but doesn't that sound like a Republican Party?
the thing with Shannon not wanting to do the blonde hair, was this the,
I didn't know that till we comes out in the script, because I wasn't going. They weren't seeing storylines; they were just getting scripts. So it was at that point, and we just had, you know, it was a good storyline. I don't remember getting a call about it. I don't remember any of that. But once she had to play it, once she didn't like being the object of it, whatever she didn't like about it, it did not come to me. It came to Aaron because she was hanging out with Tori.
Right.
She was spending time in the Spelling Mansion. The Spelling House. I'm not sure they had moved in yet. No, they hadn't moved in yet.
So she's there at the house, and she is saying, "I don't like the wig. I don't like."
I don't know if it was at the house or it was a direct call. But this was Aaron Spelling's company, so you know, she has entitled. She's the star of the series. She has entitled to do that. There's nothing wrong with that part of it. But the fact of the matter is that how is it going to be rectified? And at that point yet, she wasn't necessarily being willing to be wanting to play a character that was in on the joke and was kind of not hip and was on the side a little bit and had to
Everybody's learning each other here, right? It's the episode five, depending on how, or six, whatever it is, you know? So everybody's new.
Well, Shannon, being a veteran more than any of us, knew that the game was being won right and lost. And is this the best we can do with her character? Remember, you had already seen Brandon, have sex. At this point, and she, you know, thinking about a blonde, and they make her look like an idiot. And I don't think that was the intention, but it might have been.
It was to
have fun with the fact that the blonde wig wasn't working. Go back to be who you are.
I mean, look, the reality,
and that's a good lesson to learn. You know,
she happens to be right because the wig is terrible, and it doesn't look good. Go ahead.
The hair's supposed to look bad anyway, so I mean, it kind of fits.
We wanted to go back to her old hair,
right?
So you got to be willing. You got to be willing to play Lucy.
Sure. She did eventually.
And at that point, for whatever reason, she wasn't. However, 2.5 months later, she walks in as Laverne.
Yes.
So she was.
So let's watch this.
Now go figure. Go figure. What are they thinking, these actors?
Infamous scene here. This is one that everybody will love to see.
Yeah, this thing.
Hi.
Hi.
I thought that was you, but didn't your hair used to be a little different?
Yes. No. Well, maybe just a little bit. I hate this collar, if that's what you can call it.
It's not that bad.
One more person says that.
It's not that bad.
So now you guys out here have a thing for blondes. I mean, that's what you told Kelly.
Blondes, brunettes, redheads, girls in tank tops. But if you really hate that color, I have a friend who does hair and he owes me a favor.
Well, I don't really hate the color. But maybe we should still go see him. For a second opinion or something, don't you think?
No problem.
I like your butt. I mean your bike.
Oh, well, thank you. Hop on. My bike, that is.
Great stuff. This is the start of all that, Brenda and Dylan.
Definitely, definitely. But I'll tell you something. I got much less problem with her hair than that prudish, ridiculous top they got her in.
That's what I'm saying.
Could a sports bra be any less flattering? And you're getting on me about the wig?
Thing is, Shannon is a very cool chick. She's always been awesome and like stylish and personable. You know, when you see the pictures of her back in the day at the clubs and all that stuff, she's Shannon Doherty. She's just incredible. And they have her in this top that is just horrendous. This is not Diane Kennedy. Just to be clear, this is someone totally different. This is not Molly.
These first few season one episodes, it really seems like they were still trying
Also, look at in the stupid, her last episode was the one where she had, when we did Brandon Goes to Hollywood in that one, and he's skating and they have him out and he dressed like a pirate with the thing on his head. He looked like
a little drag on his head.
A little fucking idiot. I mean, it was like, come on, what, man? And that person, that was her last day. we shot it later. We aired it later. We had it from a different time because it was easier when you did the standalones and stuff.
All right, you have a bunch of questions here from Reddit, Brian. Oh, I want to read the thing that Diane Young said, and then we'll do the questions. This is what Diane Young said. I'm going to try to read this. Mm-hmm. As I've mentioned previously, it was difficult getting actors to audition for the show during the first season.
Yeah.
I was always grateful for when actors I knew hired previously would show up. Bill Murray was one of these actors. I had previously hired him on an episode of Just the 10 of Us. Mm-hmm. Whether or not he came in for a pre-read, I don't remember. He tended not to do with the actors I previously hired unless they wanted more info for me. In the audition, I believe we had two scenes. The first was one of the early classroom scenes, and Brandon are talking about his suits and his wife. What I remember most about Bill as an actor are the layers that he brought to the characters he played. This is evident so well in the subtleness and humanity that he brought to Mr. Denzel. It just worked. I liked him very much. And then she said the people that came in and read were William Wisdom, Ray Walston, Peter Hobbs, and Philip Sterling.
Yeah, and William Wisdom was a very well-known actor, too, and a lead of different shows. I think one was called My World and Welcome to It and things like that.
She says, I was always a sucker for actors on TV shows when I was a kid, which explains the first two names. The next names were really good working actors I knew in addition to Bill. So thank you, Diane. All right, let's see questions. Why didn't we get more backstory and scenes? Oh, sorry, Brian, this is your bit. Go ahead.
No worries. Yeah. Why didn't we get more backstory and scenes between Dylan and Kelly? Supposedly they flirted the year before, but why was it never acknowledged again before season three?
This is Cal X Riri. What I do.
It never was germane to the plot. So there the fact go. That they flirted was just, you know, background direction. I mean, they were just flirting because they knew each other and flirting, and it had a point to the storyline to form Brenda's point of view to get her to dye the hair. And you knew that Kelly kind of had a crush on him by the way she was reacting to him.
I have that. Let me show you that real quick.
We didn't have time to do a whole scene trying to weigh in on something that's a character moment.
Also, Chuck, this first season was really, it wasn't really serialized like it would become, you know, it was really like right. sort of episodes of.
No, this was old fashioned television, seasons one and two.
Yeah.
It was all standalones, yeah.
Lynn McKay. I don't know, everyone says he's trouble. Well, he can trouble me all he wants.
That's what they're talking about.
That is exactly the line I was talking.
Yeah,
and she's a party girl, so that's what she's about, you know.
Chuck, you should roll with, like, we knew we were going to do the triangle from day one. I was foreshadowing this.
I think that's what people want to hear. Yeah,
yeah, but it's not. You were not foreshadowing some triangle,
guys. This Pete Brian, this is really to you. If there's one thing to get across to Reddit people when they come up with those kind of questions, is to just remember that. We were making it up as we go along. Right. And nobody assumed that we would have to justify. So nobody was carrying a pad of this is what we did in season one, and now we're in season two, and now it's season. So that's why sometimes we had different actor. We couldn't remember who played it, or we weren't even thinking about that. You know, it was just trying to get through it, you know. So, No.
Next question. We talked about the wig. Oh, but go ahead. There's a second question there, right?
Similar, yeah. What was the original plan for Dylan? I've heard he wasn't supposed to become a regular character. Was Brenda just going to be a short fling with him?
No, the goal with Dylan was to have a guy who was different qualitatively than the others in the cast. And, you know, when I really think about it, and we did in the course of talking about the episode Isn't Romantic on this podcast, relative to the plan for Dylan, as it were. Dylan's role on the series was absolutely cemented and saved by that episode. Because to have the big deal and a special guy, there had been nothing prior to that episode that would make one think that the investment that theoretically Mr. Spelling was making. And all he was doing was paying the overage. When Duke would ask me, ask them who's paying the overage. You know, Aaron was willing to pay the overage on the character, on the cast part of, you know, Dylan McKay and for Luke. But that was the first episode that showed what he could be and what it could be. And his role was cemented as that, and particularly once Spring Dance happened. He was in it. He was in, you know, he was in the game. Yeah.
Yeah. Could not have lasted. He even came back later on after everyone was gone and sort of saved the show and gave it another life again. Go ahead, Brian. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. This is Mary Pickerford. Did Chuck draw from his own experience with former teachers with the storyline? Well, you already answered that. Did Chuck ever know any
Steve? No, but I love Mary Pickerford. Donna Martin masturbates. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Mary, I understand the temptation. Okay.
Did Chuck ever know any Steves when he was in school?
Well, yeah, I was part Steve. Part Brandon, part Steve.
All right, go ahead, Brian. There's one more here.
Oh, this is a long one. This is Zippity-Doo.10. We got a Songs of the South reference. Brandon and Andrea were written so similarly, both studious, serious, moral, competitive, into journalism. If you thought Brandon was a Boy Scout, you ain't seen nothing. At this point so early in the series, what were your long-term visions for her character? Was she always meant to be a permanent foil to Brandon and his ego? Did you ever seriously consider pairing these two up? If so, why did that not ever happen? Apologies if this has been covered already.
Well, because once you put together people in a relationship like that, you have to really, then it becomes something that needs to be cultivated. It becomes to be an obstacle. It takes on more than if you're in real life and you date for a little bit or you go out and it doesn't quite work out, but you still have to be friends in high school and that. You can't take that kind of real estate on something like that where you have one of them is a heartthrob character, theoretically, Brandon, the handsome young guy. And she was the studious one. So to see they were intellectually equals in a lot of ways, and yes, competitive in that. But the idea being that once that would become a full-bodied relationship in the way that we saw with some of the others, it wouldn't. The dynamic would change relative to, you know, being Brandon being open to all the other storylines that are available to him. And so that was one of the reasons we would not have wanted to do that right up on front. But, you know, how all the ways that Andrea developed in the series, and certainly given that in real life she had a baby right in the middle of it, I was pretty pleased with where the development went. And not, you know, again, you can't, when we're doing these series and not knowing, yes, we were ordered for 12 episodes, but not knowing if they pulled the plug before all 12 were produced, to start planning on what's going to be down the line, I don't even know if Gabrielle had met her future husband by that point.
Okay. I thought Donna looked great in this episode. I thought she looked adorable in her just to give some fashion.
It was in her, you know, pre-Felice Martin era, right? She just was a character. She didn't have storylines yet. We didn't even have to do the one with her and showing the learning disability. That even hadn't started yet.
No, I don't think so. We haven't gotten there. That would be a good one to cover, though, by the way. Okay.
Well, that's from Matthew Perry.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
We get to talk about Matthew.
I don't know that we've ever covered that episode. Have we covered
I think we did once, but we talk about Matthew if you want. I
mean, yeah, for sure. Let's do that at some point. Brian, anything else that you want to give us from Reddit? Are we okay? Or is everybody on Reddit okay now?
I think we're good.
You're speaking for all of Reddit right now.
Yeah.
They are not. I guarantee you they are not okay.
Like Chuck said, I'm the authority. So if I say they're okay,
so what's
okay.
The one thing that you're going to bring up to me now that that Pete is kind of referring to, but you don't really want to talk about that thing. What about that thing?
No. I think all of that.
There's no thing.
Not that I know.
Hear that, everybody? There's no thing here. We got nothing here. No thing. There's nothing. Okay.
No, I think you posted something today about. I mean, this is not for this show, but the Taylor Swift thing that's going on with the. With people saying that she's...
My God, give me a break.
I'm sure Reddit's all about
25
that.
25 seconds. The time breakdown is they're on that broadcast for 3.5 hours. In the box is the Grammy Award nominee whose going to be on the show that CBS is broadcasting in a week on the next Sunday night. And there she is because her boyfriend plays football for a team that just had a remarkable game. And they shot her. They stayed on her in that box for all of 25 effing seconds.
Yeah. And
Taylor Swift is not a conspiracy to demasculate the NFL.
Give me a break. That's wild. Lisa says, hi, Charles. So I just want to make sure.
Lisa. I know Lisa agrees.
Yes. All right, guys, this has been a great week. We'll be back next week with more Beverly Hills 90210 show. I have no idea what we're covering, but we will figure it out.
But the chances are I'm going to be here. So, you know, unless he gets caught up in season 9 or 10, I don't even know where to begin.
We should get get Larry back together. We missed him.
Get Larry in here. Let him talk about it. Yeah.
Yes. All right. Sounds good. See everybody next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.